might help to explain their reluctance to do so.
Western states, especially the UK, are trying to resurrect the two-state solution as they move for the first time to endorse a Palestinian state. This new move signals a recognition that the axis of resistance is winning. Better a Palestinian state than the systematic dismantling of the Zionist entity. But why do these Western states, which claim to exalt democracy, not favour a democratic solution to the occupation of Palestine? Why not offer a vote to all Palestinians and all citizens of Israel about how they want to live? Surely this would be an elegant solution which would show a true commitment to democracy. As it happens, there is one state that has proposed a democratic solution to the occupation. That is the Islamic Republic of Iran. In November last year, the Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian emphasized again the right of the Palestinian people to determine their own destiny, saying a referendum would be a complete solution to the Palestinian question. The dimensions of this idea have been officially registered by the Islamic Republic of Iran in the United Nations, Amir Abdullahian said. Efforts to promote the idea have been made in various bilateral, regional and international fora. At present, all those living in historic Palestine, including additional territories such as the Golan, amount to 7.2 million Jews, 48.6%, and 7.1 million Palestinians, 47.7%. In addition, there are a further 7 million Palestinians in the diaspora, 6.3 million in Arab countries, and around 750,000 elsewhere. Of this total of 21 million, therefore, some two-thirds are Palestinian. These figures reveal the stark nightmare for the Zionists. In any democratic process, the so-called State of Israel would be voted into the dustbin of history. There is no mandate in the territory of historic Palestine for a Jewish state, and there never will be. As the minister, Amir Abdullahian, put it in November, the Zionist regime, in the shadow of its inability to confront the resistance forces, took revenge on the defenseless people of Gaza and the West Bank, which resulted in committing genocide and war crimes. It is plain that the bloodlust visible in the revenge on Gaza is driven by the sure and certain knowledge of the Zionists that they are outnumbered and their genocidal settler colonial ethno-state can only survive by force of arms. The question now is, how long can that endure?
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And I'm pleased to welcome back Batul Sabeti as our guest contributor today, who joins us via Skype. Batul is a human rights activist and has a special interest in analysing political and social issues. She blogs at Stances to Salvation, and in her professional life, she's a chemical engineer based in London. Welcome to the show. David, what do you make of the Islamic Republic of Iran's proposal for a democratic solution that Latifa referred to in her report just there?
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because it's the West that believes in democracy, surely. That's the whole way in which they present themselves. And, of course, the Israelis say that they're the only democracy in the Middle East. But they won't, of course, engage in any kind of democratic process in relation to the territory of historic Palestine, because they know they would lose. And of course, this is a signal feature of settler colonialism, and that's why, in the case of Northern Ireland, they drew the border of Northern Ireland so that there would always be a Protestant majority in perpetuity, a majority which is now, a century later, starting to dissipate over the edge. So that's the point of this, that they will not allow democracy, because democracy would mean that they would lose. There's no mandate for a Jewish state in Palestine. There's a mandate amongst the plurality of the people of Palestine, including the Jews, including settlers who've come in recent times, for a one-state solution, a one-state, a Palestinian state, in which all would have equal rights. That's, of course, what should happen in Palestine. And that's what would come out of a democratic process. And that, of course, is why the Zionists cannot contemplate democracy. And that's why they must exclude the people of Gaza, the people of the West Bank, and indeed what are called the Israeli Arabs, the Palestinians living in 48 Israel, from any democratic process. That's why they do that, and that's why they have to do that. And, of course, that's why they're committing genocide in Gaza, to mow the lawn as it's said.
That's euphemism, appalling euphemism that they use. But Batul, why is there not more support, do you think, for this idea in the West?
Right. Even the UN resolutions, you know, like Palestinians have the right to return or the occupation of the West Bank is illegal, have effectively been placed on the shelves. And the West has not enforced it, you know, of course, despite recognising the 1967 occupations of the Gaza and West Bank as illegal. But this begs the question of why. It's because there's no will to enact justice, you know, let alone a solution for a referendum. You know, if the West has the choice, it will simply turn a blind eye to the excess expansionism of the Israeli occupation entity beyond, in fact, the borders that the West defined for them to begin with, you know, which was 55% of the land in 1948. You know, the Israeli occupation entity, at the end of the day, is the project of the Imperial West. The entity is effectively today bound by the supreme American interests. You know, the West, at the end of the day, used the Zionist movement as a vehicle to fulfill its functional role in a region of strategic importance. So, of course, the West has no interest in changing this unjust status quo on the ground that it has founded, unless, and there is one exception, unless it is forced to do that due to the shift in the balance of powers on the ground that would be imposed by the resistance.
Yeah. Well, David, I mean, how would this work then in reality? I mean, would every settler get a vote, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, of course, it's not for me to say how the people of Palestine should organise their affairs. That's for the people of Palestine.
Sure, of course, yeah.
The proposal from the Iranian government says that all of the people of historic Palestine should have a vote. I mean, they say explicitly Muslims, Christians and Jews.
Right.
The question about which settlers would get a vote, you know, presumably there would be some kind of discussion about that. Right. One would imagine that in any such vote that those who were there by 48 or 67 probably would get a vote. Once who came later, there may be an argument about that. But even if all of the settlers, you know, including the most recent ones from New York, who've said that they have to steal someone's home because if they don't do it, someone else will do it for them. Even if they all got a vote, and you know, some people would be sceptical about whether they should, they would still lose.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the crux of the matter. If that was a process which was happening, then many of them would decide to leave. Some would leave, some would fight, and others would, you know, potentially get used to the idea and come to live in a one-state Palestine. And the question of the proportion of those is something for history to decide.
Indeed. Well, Batul, I mean, would it be fair, do you think, to give all recent Zionist settlers a vote then?
The Israeli occupation entity is an expression of settlers in its totality. These settlers, all of them, partook in uprooting Palestinians and dispossessing their right to a home and livelihood. So those who effectively aided and committed those crimes and who came in as fighters and actually continued within the military complex in these 7.5 decades, of course they have no right to vote because they are the reason for the Palestinian subjugation to the worst form of violence for over 7.5 decades. You know, the hundreds of and thousands of Palestinians displaced who ended up as refugees in the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, in what we call the Nakba today. You know, in 1948, in fact, Gaza was under Egyptian power, you know, and the West Bank was under Jordanian power. You know, so even the Israeli occupation entity's borders in 1948 were not the land that it controls today. You know, 80% of Gazans today are refugees. You know, even the Palestinian Christian population did not remain. So in terms of who is able to remain under this new autonomous Palestinian system of governance, you know, such as those settlers who did not in a direct sense partake in the wars or join the occupation forces, all of that would be subject to the Palestinians themselves. That is the Palestinian decision to make. But in any case, accountability is a key element of any process of justice.
So, I mean, from you know, from what you've both been saying then, David, I mean, the demographics are pretty stark, aren't there? I mean, there should be a huge Palestinian majority, wouldn't there?
There would be, and people, I guess people don't really realise that. They sort of think there's about the same amount of people there are, roughly, in the territory currently. But, of course, all the refugees should have a right to vote, have the right to return. That's enshrined in UN decision-making, and of course it's a fundamental demand of the Palestinian liberation movement. So that would have to happen. And of course the whole question about the theft of land and the settlements and who would live where, that would all have to be sorted out as well. That's of course not an easy thing to do, but that would have to be and could be sorted out. But look, I think the question here is what do you do with those that have been in the front line of stealing land, of assassinating, killing, murdering ethnically cleansing the Palestinian people. Now, of course, there is a model for this, and you can see the suspect Netanyahu here, which is that the key criminals would have to be dealt with in the justice system, just like you would do in any other society where there is a genocide. So that deals with some of the question, but what remains is how you move on to something called de-Zionization. I think we might talk about a bit more later in the programme.
Yeah, indeed. this would lead, wouldn't it, to the collapse of the Zionist entity.
Right, so is our objective settler colonial apartheid remaining, or the restoration of justice is the question. So whatever justice demands should happen. This is the only solution to putting things straight. You know, without this referendum, the massacres will continue. Israeli expansionism without limits will continue, because as long as the occupation entity is able to expand, it will. Its slogan is from the Nile to the Euphrates. You know, this is the least price paid for the crimes of 7.5 decades of Palestinian subjugation that is unlike anything that humanity has witnessed. And no one has the right to decide for Palestinians how much portion of the land they get, the security arrangement, giving up arms, right? You know, America simply gives orders as the police state of the world. This should happen, that should happen. The solution is for every Palestinian who was before the Nakba and still on the land of Palestine and all of their descendants across the diaspora to decide by a free referendum the form of their state, their system of governance. This is the correction, this is the reversal of this biggest shame and sin that occurred in 1948. This sin needs to be acknowledged, corrected, accounted for, and compensated.
Well, we'll come back to the discussion in a moment. I'd like to get your views, and David's obviously, on our next report about why a process of de-Zionization is urgently required.
The only just and workable solution to the problem of the occupation of Palestine is to end the Zionist colony. But how could the Palestinians be expected or in practice accomplish living in peace with millions of genocidal Zionists? De-Zionization is clearly necessary, but what would it involve? After the end of the 1939-1945 war, it was clear that the entirety of German society would need to be cleansed of Nazi influences and effects, and that the Germans would need to be re-educated. A key problem was what to do with the millions of Germans who had belonged to one or another Nazi organization. How to denazify them?
Judges from Britain, America, Russia, and France assemble in Nuremberg's courthouse. Empowered to impose sentence of death, or such punishment as it may consider just, the tribunal sits in judgment upon 20 leaders of the Nazi Party.
Perhaps the most iconic part of the process was the Nuremberg tribunals, at which leading Nazis were arraigned. The tribunals also had a key lasting effect on international humanitarian law, which we can see in today's ICJ judgment that Israel is plausibly committing genocide in Gaza. In relation to Palestine, a large number of war criminals would need to be tried and sanctioned. The idea that they could ever commit genocide in Palestine must be firmly smashed. Once the material support for racist ideas is removed, then the ideas themselves are starved of sustenance. Once the British left most of Ireland in 1920, there were unionists in the Irish Free State who were bitterly and obstinately committed to Ireland remaining a colony of Britain. But after the declaration of a republic in 1948 and the fact of Irish independence, most unionists gave up. Within a generation, they had come to think of themselves as Irish. The lesson for Palestine is that material circumstances supporting Zionist ideology must change, and then it will be possible to dismantle Zionism. De-Zionization means, first of all, dismantling Zionist organizations. This can be done by disbanding key organizations such that they cease to exist. Most obviously, this would include the World Zionist Organization and all of its affiliates all over the world. But there are Zionist organizations which can have legitimate functions in society should they be effectively de-Zionized. Today, there are many Jewish groups that could be encouraged to disaffiliate from the genocidal ideology of Zionism. There's no reason to close schools, synagogues, student groups, which can and should be encouraged to disavow Zionism and to provide places of learning, worship, or representation for all. But make no mistake, formerly Zionist groups would have to cease to exist wherever they are found.
David, the report there just talked about the denazification of Germany after World War II. Just explain that process a little bit more, will you?
So, at the end of the war in 1945, the Allies, the Soviets, British, the Americans, decided at Yalta that they would have to denazify Germany. That didn't mean that they would have to arrest and try war criminals, as we see here, Hermann Göring at the Nuremberg Tribunal. It meant that the whole society had to be changed, had to be cleansed of Nazi ideology. That meant, for example, that the millions of people who'd been active members of Nazi organisations would have to be constrained or have to be questioned, have to go through the re-education process. And that's, of course, something you certainly would have to do with the Zionists. It's not just that we'd have to have Netanyahu in the dock following Göring or Yoav Gallant following Ribbentrop or Isaac Herzog following Rudolf Hess. You would have to have that, but you would also have to have all of those who'd been key Zionist organisations, like, of course, the so-called Israel Defence Forces, like the police, and like some of the key ideological Zionist groups, the Jewish National Front, for example, the World Zionist Organisation. All of these people would have to go through re-education. Mm. The rest would not necessarily have to go through that process. And that, of course, was a process which didn't go very well in the end. It wasn't very thoroughgoing. The Americans did better with it than did the British and the French. They didn't care. And, of course, they rehabilitated some of the Nazis to become NATO officers, etc. The Soviets did better than the British and the French, too, as you might expect. Mm. But that was a process which, in the end, was curtailed by the move to the Cold War. And so effectively, what happened in the case, for example, in the UK, there thousands and thousands of Ukrainian Nazis who were brought to the UK in 1947, they were kept in camps for a year, and then they just let them go. Mm. There was no denazification process at all. And those Nazis, the descendants of those Nazis, remain, some of them in the UK, supporting the Nazis in Ukraine to this day. So there's a problem with denazification in the sense it wasn't properly carried out, in my opinion.
So you think the kind of Nuremberg trials offer some sort of a blueprint, but it needs to be a bit more rigorously...
A much wider process of de-Zionisation, that's right.
Right, OK. Well, Batul, I mean, the Nuremberg trials were a touchstone, weren't they, for the creation of international humanitarian law. Is there a danger, do you think, of moving away from those principles at the International Court of Justice?
Right, so the same entities that effectively established these humanitarian laws are committing the same crimes these laws are designed to prevent, you know, according to the ICJ's verdict of plausible genocide. So what we can effectively conclude from this is that the laws did not come out for the sake of justice, but for Western political interests, you know, to establish the Israeli occupation entity and to enable the settlers to occupy Palestine. You know, the Holocaust, we all know, was just the pretext for the creation of the wrong state in 1948, because we know the Balfour Declaration is the baseline. You know, the Nakba was systemically planned, and Jewish immigration from around the world to Palestine went on since the beginning of the last century under the colonial British mandate. You know, the first entities to recognize the wrong Israeli occupation entity was the US and the Soviet Union. You know, so even if we want to go with the argument that, you know, there were humanitarian motives for establishing this Jewish homeland, the reality for 7.5 decades has been mass expulsion and massacres. You know, I mean, even the Palestinians within 1948 are stripped of their rights and relegated to low-class citizenship. I mean, the entity even treats Eastern Jews as lower class than Western Jews. That's how inherent the racism is.
Yes, indeed. Well, David, I mean, which Zionist groups then do you think should be disbanded, in your opinion?
Well, I think, again, you use the Nazi example. But what do we think about the NSDAP and the Hitler Youth? And obviously, those organisations have to be sorted out.
Sure.
In the case of the World Zionist Organisation, that's an organisation which is at the forefront of ethnic cleansing through its various agencies, through the Jewish Agency and through the Jewish National Fund, which steals Palestinian land. So those organisations have to be disbanded. In every country, there's a Zionist movement. There's a Zionist Federation. There's one in the UK, one in the US, many other countries. And they have multiple members. Most of those organisations would have to go.
Yeah.
But there are some of the organisations that are currently part of the World Zionist Organisation who you know, plausibly could disaffiliate. And there's been discussions, for example, in the Union of Jewish Students, Zionist organization, about whether it should be a Zionist or a non-Zionist organization. Currently it's a Zionist organization, but there is this very small minority within the UJS pushing for a a post or a non-Zionist position. That's the way that these organisations would have to go. Otherwise, they have to be removed. Otherwise, they continue to be genocidal and racist. Other organisations, like, for example, the Conservative Friends of Israel and the Labour Friends of Israel, not formally part of the Zionist movement, but absolutely to the core about promoting the idea of a genocidal Jewish state. And so they would have to go. Of course, we should have a proper Friends of Palestine group in the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. We don't currently have proper groups like that. But that, of course, could replace those organisations. So there's a variety of things on offer here. I mean, I think the key thing is that you can't go about dissolving almost all of the synagogues in the UK. Almost all of the synagogues are parts of synagogue movements which are formally Zionist. The Jews have to have somewhere to worship. You couldn't possibly attack their rights in that kind of way. No. But they don't have to be Zionist synagogues. No. They didn't used to be Zionist synagogues before the Zionist movement took over the whole of the organised Jewish community.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Batul, I mean, why do you think these ideas about de-Zionisation are only just getting significant attention now?
Absolutely. It's all down to the blood of Gaza. You know, the blood of Gaza has effectively awakened the mass conscious of the world. The scale of atrocities and the genocide just can't be ignored. And these masks are falling. The nations are waking up. Compare this to a few years ago, though, when the situation was entirely different when Trump, you know, brokered the Abraham Accords. The Israeli occupation entity effectively then had the upper hand and there was worldwide silence, which would have, in fact, continued had the Palestinians, who are victims, not resisted and, in fact, rather accepted the humiliation of their occupiers. So really only the blood of Gaza has forced the West to, you know, seriously consider this two-state solution such that it sees no other way out, you know, because to continue besieging Gaza is really shooting the West in the foot, and the Israeli occupation entity's security is existentially threatened post-October the 7th. Nothing can take that away. So whilst the West is, you know, apprehensive to admit the genocide effectively, it wants solutions because the region is too important for it, and it cannot remain unstable, this region, for Western interests. So, you know, the West is looking for some form of minimum stability, but ultimately the magnitude of the cumulative aggressive policies against the Palestinians in the region is what has inevitably led to the instability of Western interests in the first place, and it's pushing this whole rhetoric behind de-Zionisation.
Yeah. David, just to explain your thinking as well, just expand a little bit more, will you, about why you feel then that... you know, that some Zionist organisations, you know, should be allowed to continue, but in a different form.
Well, if we're going to talk about ending the racist ideology of Zionism, we have to end the circumstances which produce it, and that of course, is the organisations and the money which goes to support those organisations. So it's perfectly possible for, I mean, let's take the Board of Deputies, for example. The Board of Deputies of British Jews used to be a non-Zionist or anti-Zionist, in fact, organisation until it was captured through a process in the 1940s before the creation of the so-called State of Israel. It could go back to being a non- or anti-Zionist organisation. There's no reason why that couldn't be the case, and the same would be the case with the synagogue movements. Most of the synagogue movements in the UK, representing the overwhelming majority of synagogues, Reform, Liberal, the United Synagogue, they're all Zionist. Now, the only major one which is not Zionist is the Union of Orthodox Hebrew Congregations, which is the ultra-Orthodox representative. Now, amongst the different sorts of groups that are represented in those the synagogues that are part of that organisation are anti-Zionist synagogues. Now, that is a potential model for how these things could happen. That organisation is not Zionist, and that's how all of them should be, in order that we can get rid of the racism of Zionism.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you for that. But unfortunately, we are out of time again. So let me thank our guest, Batul Sabeti, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat
is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
آدم برای خودش مراقبه‌های کوتاه مدت بگذاره.
In order to control our sexual desire, we must practice short-term and long-term self-accounting. This means to promise Allah not to commit a sin for a day, and if we did so, we compensate for that with a good action or helping others. If we repeat practicing self-accounting and we stop sinning for several days and we continue it to 40 days, then it becomes a habit for us.
فکر و خیالش مواظب باشه. گاهی موقع آدم چشمش مواظبه، چشمش حرام نمیبینه، اما فکر و خیالش خدا نکرده هرزه.
Beside eyes and ears, we must be careful about our thoughts and imagination too. This means that we must not even let satanic thoughts or imaginations enter our mind and soul. This is because even thinking about a sin without doing the very act of sinning prepares the ground for doing it in the near future. Thinking about a sin is like making fire in a white house and gradually blackening the white color of the house. Thinking about a sin also darkens the soul in a gradual manner. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In Britain, various charities have warned there has been a dramatic rise in the number of homeless young people since Christmas. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Sky News has covered this story and tells us more. A charity said the number of young people who said they were homeless or about to become homeless has risen by nearly 7,000 in the last year. Research by Centrepoint found that 135,800 young people aged between 16 and 24 told their local council they were homeless in 2022-2023, up from 129,000 the year before, representing a rise of 6,800. The charity says that is around 372 per day and a new person facing homelessness every 4 minutes. London was the worst affected place in England and Wales with 20,200 homeless young people. Centrepoint also found more than 3 in 10 young people were not assessed when they approached their local council for help. In response to the mounting crisis, 120 youth and youth homelessness charities have backed a petition urging ministers to create a national strategy to tackle the problem. Ben, who didn't want to reveal his full name, has been homeless on and off since he was 11 years old. At 19, he was kicked out of the family home after being accused of a crime he said he did not commit. The case was later dropped. He said he was forced onto the streets but found himself under mental health care after being awake for 4 days in a row. These experiences nearly drove him to suicide. He said, "I was in a train station, the underground station, and about to walk in front of a train and someone stopped me. I was sectioned for a week because of my sleep deprivation and my anxiety." One of the charities leading the calls for a national strategy is New Horizon Youth Centre, which supports young Londoners who find themselves homeless. The centre's concern is that these new figures are the tip of the iceberg, as only 51% of young people using their services say they approached their local council to report themselves as homeless. Over the summer months, when the New Horizon Youth Centre is usually quietest, their staff said there was a 69% increase in demand by daily users. The chief executive, Phil Kerry, said, "If I arrive at a centre, sometimes I have to step over people in sleeping bags. We're fed up of having young people crying, feeling suicidal, with nowhere to go." In 2022, the government launched the so-called End Rough Sleeping for Good, a £2 billion programme aimed at making the United Kingdom a world leader in its approach to ending rough sleeping. This includes investment of up to £500 million in funding to local authorities across England from April of 2022 through to March of 2025. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Charities have warned there has been a dramatic rise in the number of homeless young people in the United Kingdom since Christmas. The New Horizon Youth Centre in London said a record number of young people had asked it for help in the first week of January, while the charity, AKT, which supports homeless people, said it had seen more referrals than it would expect in a month. Roundabout in Sheffield and YMCA Trinity, which operates in Cambridgeshire and Suffolk, also reported increases. A coalition of 120 charities has come together under the banner Plan for the 136K, which refers to an estimate that there were 136,000 homeless young people in 2023, to call on the government to create a national strategy to end youth homelessness. They are asking people to support a parliamentary petition to force a response from ministers. Research by the charity Centrepoint estimated that 135,800 young people approached their council as homeless in 2022-2023. And Shelter said last month it believed the extra 40,000 people of all ages would be homeless at Christmas. But there is alarm at the rise in the numbers since then. Phil Kerry, the chief executive of the New Horizons Centre, said, "We can see this is spiralling rapidly. By the start of last week, the centre had already seen 142 people, compared with a weekly average of just 63. He said New Horizons Centre was the only open access space in London for homeless young people under the age of 25. Hayley Speed, a member of the AKT charity, said there has been a dramatic rise in demand for specialist youth homeless services. She said demand has skyrocketed. She said our London referrals have received more requests in the first week of January than we would usually expect over the whole month. It's double our weekly average. According to the chief executive, Ben Keegan, in South Yorkshire, Roundabouts Sheffield Centre was the busiest it's ever been. Ben Keegan said, "We've taken over former student accommodation just to help meet the ever-growing demand from young people in desperate housing need in our region. The rise comes on top of a 21% increase in the number of homeless young people last year, rising to 1,876. YMCA Trinity works with young people in Peterborough, Cambridgeshire and in Suffolk. John Martin, the chief executive of YMCA Trinity, said, "Across our area, we're seeing increasing demand for our youth housing services. Some of this is young people leaving the care system, or for others, finding themselves homeless due to family breakup or challenging circumstances where they live. Some of it is driven by low housing supply, especially at the entry level. High rents and also high living costs." John Martin added, "All are coming to us with increasing complex needs, including issues with mental health, adverse childhood experiences and trauma." Kate Paulson, the chief executive of the Scottish youth homelessness charity Rock Trust, said, "Young people are doubly disadvantaged as they are more likely to be in insecure, low-paid work and are less likely to have savings and references, and we need to address this if we are to end youth homelessness."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A'udhu billah minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah the Almighty, who created us for the sake of us worshipping Him, because in this case can we reach perfection and happiness and salvation. Welcome to another episode of the program, Islamic Upbringing. Here we are dealing with the very difficult task of parenting, which is the journey of educating yourself first and then your loved one. In the studio, we have Sayyid Salman Naqawi, who is a faculty member of Islamic Studies in Al-Mustafa International University. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid, and welcome.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We've been trying to talk about transformational parenting, which creates leaders, you know, imams of the society. We provided a brief summary of the benefits of raising transformational kids. And in this program, we would like to, inshallah, mention the four features of this parenting style.
Yes, thank you very much. So transformational parenting, as in contrast with transactional parenting, is about building a bond of trust, bonding of trust between the parents and the young children. And understanding the fact that every child, every human being has his own unique potentials. That unique potential has to be actualized. We should stop setting him in our own image. I mean, a successful parent is a person who can deliver a child, a person to this society, into society, who goes beyond what the parents have done and achieved. They should excel. A parent should be very happy about the fact that his child is excelling. So that can only happen if the child sees a person who is supportive and not over-protective.
Right, so
we shouldn't have a predetermined image that we need
To fit them in.
We need to let them realize fly. Their potential and fly. Give them, guide them how to fly. Don't take their hands and make them fly.
Right.
Make wings out of your hands. Maybe make them fly with your hands.
Right. Don't put them on your back and fly yourself, so that they fly along with you.
No. Yes. They should be able to fly on their own.
Exactly.
Teach them to fly. Teach them to fish. Don't catch the fish for them.
Exactly.
That is important. That is every educator, every leader should be doing that. Every parent should be doing that. It's about the longer-term goals, not things to be done immediately. Maybe on the way, the child is going to fall down many times while he's trying to fly, while he's trying to take a long jump. Many times he will be unsuccessful. Nothing to be embarrassed about. Every failure leads to success. But the moment you start yelling at him, the moment you start scolding him for being a failure, then he's not going to go out again. He's not going to feel that confidence. You need to teach them to master the abilities, the capabilities that are required, the longer-term goals, the skills required to achieve long-term success.
So if
habits.
They fall down, instead of screaming at them and saying, oh, you're so clumsy, I mean, falling metaphorically, when they make a mistake, I should go very gently to the child and, you know, show my sympathy, show my understanding.
Not sympathy, empathy.
Empathy, right. And tell them, reassure them that they can once more stand on their two feet and start to walk even better than before.
And the most important thing is to listen, be able to listen to them. You have to be good listeners. Every leader has to be a good listener. The Holy Prophet is mentioned in the Quran as "Huwa udhunu khairin lakum." He listens to you.
This is so important, because this, we shouldn't forget that our, I mean, family is the most fundamental institution in the eyes of God, right? And we're raising our children, of course, for the society, but before entering the society, they have to be future parents, future spouses, and whatever feature or trait that you instill in them, they're going to use it for their spouses. And if their spousal relationship is successful, they're going to have a successful offspring, and they're going to be successful in the society. So if you're a good listener, they're going to learn to be good listeners with their children, with their spouses, and this is one of the keys of happiness.
You need to be able to talk to them, discuss with them, even argue with them, tell them how to reason things with things, give them profound reasoning, talk to them, discuss with them, listen to their ideas, listen to their reasoning. Don't become judgmental. Let them come out with what they want to say, express what they want to say. Try to understand their line of reasoning. Don't impose your own reasoning upon them. Present your reasoning, let them come up with their reasoning, and let them come to a situation where they can critically analyze things, evaluate things, even come up with new ideas.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't be afraid of new ideas. We shouldn't be afraid of creativity in our children. We let them need to become creative human beings. They have to be able to evaluate things.
Right. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the qualities and features of transformational parenting, which was establishing a bonding of trust between parent and child, realizing that every child possesses unique potentials, focusing on long-term goals, disregarding short-term failures, being a good listener, not being judgmental. What else?
Yes, and basically the bonding has been to based on love, mm-hmm. affection, compassion, empathizing with them, feeling. I mean, this everything should be done out of love. Haliddin illal hub. So it starts with the love of God, mm-hmm. and then it comes down and trickles down to all His creations, especially one's parents and children and siblings and so on and so forth. So we need to develop that attitude, that loving attitude. It's not, again, it's all for the sake of Allah. This is important. So number one, the transformational parent empowers the child, empowers him, and seeks the best for the interests of the teenager. The best interest of the teenager is that he becomes submissive to Allah Almighty, loves Allah Almighty. And love can only come without la ikraha fi din. What does that mean?
No compulsion in religion.
No, I don't think that's it. La ikraha, you don't do anything in deen without accepting it, loving to do it, wanting to do it.
Mm-hmm. Deeply desiring to do something.
Ikraha is something, making someone do something out of
compulsion.
Compulsion. Not in the sense of jabr, because jabr is something else.
You just have to do it because for the sake of doing it, having that done.
So, like Rafid Deen, it's not that we don't want people want to obey Allah. We want people to obey Allah out of love for Allah.
Right.
Not because, we have to do it because we have to do it.
Right.
Like Rafid Deen, in my humble opinion, means whatever we do in the realm of Deen, and everything we do should be in the realm of Deen, mm-hmm. it should be out of the love of Allah.
Right.
Like, it shouldn't be because have to do it even if I hate to do so.
Right.
Even if I don't want to do so. That shouldn't be this case. Like Rafid Deen, nothing should be done out of force, out of compulsion, out of a feeling of remorse, out of feeling of hatred. No, it should be done for the sake of the love of Allah, for the sake of the love of Allah Almighty.
Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. We've been talking about qualities and traits of transformational parenting. The Sayyid mentioned a very important point that in order to raise very empowered, unique children, you have to love them with all your heart, and they have to really understand that they're in, they're in loving hands. And I think, as you said previously, I mean, this happens because, unlike other parenting teaching in other, you know, like from the perspective of psychology, Islamic upbringing focuses on child upbringing from before the conception of a child, and it talks about the importance of establishing a very good and respected relationship with your spouse as the laying the foundation of parenting, right?
Exactly.
So, Haladdino illa al-hub, this, if you only practice this single hadith, you have a beautiful life ahead of you, because you can't wait until your child reaches like 13, 14, 16 and you say, "Okay, I love you. It doesn't work like that, right? The child, the way you treat your wife, the way you treat your husband, you're teaching. Didn't you say that you should be preaching religion without your tongue and with your actions? And the child really understand the emotions, deep emotions. So parents, learn to love yourselves, love your wives, your husbands, and your children with all your heart.
That's a good message, very powerful message. So we need to take care of that empowerment, loving our children with all our hearts, and make them come out with the potential which is in there should come out. And then number two, in transformational parenting, needs to promote autonomy, self-esteem, confidence. Competence has to be developed. The child is able to do things in a competent way. And the more we do things competently, the more confidence we acquire. And it has a, you know, step-like, ladder-like formation, that the more you do things properly, the more you go up the ladder.
And I think part of this confidence or sense of autonomy comes from the fact that you raise your child in a very respected way, right? I mean, I've seen how different parents deal with or, you know, engage in conversations or react to the actions or behaviors of their children. This is the end of another episode of our program, Islamic Upbringing. We are so happy to have your questions and comments. And if you have anything that we can ask the expert of our program, feel free to write to us at englishradio@irib.ir. Thank you for listening to us. And wa akhiru da'wana an alhamdu lillahi rabbil alameen.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is